Hey everyone, so glad you can join us here on our podcast, Perspectives. In this episode, I am going to be chatting with the wonderful Sophie Howard, who is an Amazon queen. So I have been fascinated for some time about how well Amazon does. It's growing at a tremendous rate. We discover in the podcast it's grown, I think, by 44% in the last 12 months during these very interesting and challenging times. Sophie has an interesting story. She started in 2014 learning. She had a full-time job, two children, brand new baby, was trying to figure out, how do I do this all and make it work and make it wonderful? And it wasn't really clear to how her pathway was. So she began to assess and look at the marketplace and figure out, well, what suits me? I want to work from home. I want flexibility. And she came up with Amazon. So we talk in this episode about how she came to Amazon and what it was her criteria for choosing to become an Amazon seller. She sold a couple of Amazon businesses. She sold her first Amazon business after 18 months for $1 million. It's a really great story. And then how she approached it and how she got into it. I think Sophie's terrific in her approach. You're going to hear how she's approached, how she chooses her products, how she builds relationships with people. It isn't this slam bam, let's just get a product up there and hope it sells and I can clean up attitude about it at all. It's a really considered attitude that I respect a lot, because I know what it takes to succeed in business. And it isn't just turning up, wishing it could happen, hoping it can happen, not throwing everything at it and giving a short amount of time. Sophie has given it the time it deserves. So I find that a really intriguing and inspiring attitude she's brought to it, considering you think she'd never had any experience on Amazon before that, had never known how to do it, didn't know how it worked. And she breaks down what she looked at, how she thought about it. We talk about entrepreneurship. We talk about the mindset of handling ambiguity, especially in times where there's so much ambiguity in the pathway, so unclear to so many people. What is it we need to do to navigate that path? We talk about what isn't going to work in Amazon and what is, what she's focusing on now, and gives some really intriguing insights into how to think about what's the perspective we need to be a success in business. I share some of my stories about, pretty woeful stories about how things started out for me and how tough it was, and probably some of the mistakes that we made started out as well. Sometimes the success story that we're seeing is built on some of the tougher times earlier and some mistakes and doing it really tough. So I like having that level of honesty in a conversation. I think it's important that it isn't just, wow, they've done so well. It's, well, there was plenty of grind and there was plenty of hardship and, you know, marriages have broken up, as Sophie shared, and things don't always go as swimmingly as it can sometimes appear at first glance. And I think to respect a success, we really need to respect the story that led to that and everything that comes along with how we define success. So I trust you enjoy this episode of Perspectives with Sophie Howard. Thanks so much for joining me today, Sophie. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you, Sharon. Looking forward to this very much. I'm a big fan of yours. I feel like I know you. We've got lots of mutual friends. I've hired people that you've trained. I'm friends with people you've trained. Even my dressage instructor, who has an online coaching business, you trained. So you're all over my life.
And of course, we know John, both of us know John Anderson.
Yeah. John Anderson, he's fabulous. So
we're business partners. Kindest human being. He's just lovely.
He's very funny. He's great to be on the road with. He's just a laugh a minute and super smart, super hardworking, top bloke.
Yeah, he's very smart and fast. Sometimes his humor, if I'm with him having lunch and one of my friends sends a text that needs a funny reply, John, what would you say to this? And my funniest replies are always, coincidentally, when I'm with John Anderson. So, Sophie, you are an Amazon queen. You're an Amazon success story. And I'm not sure what we're going to title this podcast episode, but it'll be something like that. I'm always intrigued, love getting to know and talking with and learning from people who have done something that is extraordinary in any field. And what I admire about what you've done is, to me, and this is my perspective, Amazon feels like the Wild West. I am still in that era where it feels, I wouldn't know where to start. I wouldn't know how to think about it. I find it intimidating. I didn't even know I knew all of that about me. There you go. And I find it quite, yet I can run these other businesses and I don't even think about it. But as soon as I heard a few years ago about what you do in Amazon, I was immediately intrigued. So I don't know where we'll start there, but is there some thread you can pick up from there other than to say, goodness sake, get on with it?
Well, I had no affinity for Amazon. We don't have Amazon here in New Zealand. I had no connection with the company at all when I heard about it as a business opportunity. So I'd been blundering around looking for things I could do from home to generate decent income, not pottering around hobby type income, but grow a proper business. And the thing that appealed about the Amazon business model is that it's very scalable and entirely online. So that was the big thing. And not too many humans, better at things than humans, it turns out. So the idea of having lots of staff or having big overheads or offices or managing lots of people while I had a baby at home on maternity leave, that was quite off-putting. But a business that was product-based was really appealing. And it was selling real products to real people. So I could sort of picture what was going on. And I know you've talked in the past about cryptocurrency and all the different online business things, and they're so out of your control. There's nothing tangible. And this is something I could picture exactly how I could do it well, win at it, scale it, you know, get good at something quickly. So it was nothing to do with any background in technology or Amazon as a company or any online shopping or product research skills. It was just it ticked the boxes when I was out looking for a business opportunity.
Yeah. Okay. So tell us a little, let the viewers know you a little bit. What was the story that got you to the moment when you became a brand new Amazon trader?
Oh, I was also a brand new mum, second time round. So I had a very noisy, squawky little baby who was not a good sleeper. The first one was a dream, 12 hours solid. Should have written a book about it.
And you thought, this is easy.
And along comes party girl Lottie, hello. And off we went. So I was on 24/7 and I was working in the Foreign Office in New Zealand for central government. So you're equivalent to DFAT in Australia. So big job. Big pressure, you know, ministers wanting papers now, trips overseas now, you know, full on, full noise. And they were very good to me. They gave me as much flexibility as humanly possible. But by the time I'd paid a nanny and come home exhausted, and the children were asleep when I got home, and I was just a wreck. I was sort of a shadow of my former self, and it was not sustainable. So something was going to give. And we weren't getting ahead financially that way either, because I was working part-time hours, paying a nanny, commuting, all the city stuff. So it was all a bit hard. So I was like, right, we need to change this. And I wasn't sure what to do. And I'm naturally pretty risk averse. You know, I'm not going to stumble into something as a complete optimist, you know, what you would call magical thinking. I didn't just think I would turn up and be ace at something just because I manifested it or something. I was like, right, I need some new skills that I can work from home. And I looked at, you know, all that affiliate marketing, and I looked at all the network marketing. That's not me. I'm quite introverted and live in the middle of nowhere. So it had to be something online without too many people. So I sort of looked at products. I looked at various online trading things. Couldn't really work out who I could trust, what was real, what could I control, what was just a complete ripoff or a scam. It was a wild west. So you think Amazon's a wild west, I reckon. Amazon was quite a safe haven because you can see it's a stable platform. They've been around for 20 years. I mean, you could build your whole business on Instagram or Google SEO or something, and they change an algorithm overnight and you're gone. Or you thought MySpace was the next big thing and you build your whole business on there. I felt Amazon was pretty stable. The rules are pretty clear but pretty strict. So that's good. You know, if it's a tough, hard, you know, clear line of what's above and below the board as a seller, it means that there shouldn't be too many dodgy characters getting away with bad behavior on there. Whereas in other areas of e-commerce, it's really rough and sort of serious aggressive tactics and dodgy goings on. So I didn't want to kind of try and play against those kind of guys. So I could see if I did a quality product, pitched it at the high end to a discerning market, had a unique product that was hard to copy. So I've got a background in business before doing this. And so I could just see that everyone else doing this copycat thing, you know, find an existing bestseller, get someone off Alibaba to whip it up really cheaply in a factory, mass produce this and ship it in and copy what's already there. That just did not seem like a sensible business strategy at all. Like, if it was easy for me to copy them.
Slow down. Why? Because I'm still stuck on Wild West. Remember who you're speaking with, like complete novice. I have bought books on Amazon and still haven't gone to any other category at all.
Yeah.
And I still treat it like a bookseller.
Yeah. You,
I'm a dinosaur when it comes to this thinking. So please just slow down a little bit just on that point there and unpack that a little bit. So I was, when you were looking at Amazon, that was 2014. I was looking at affiliate sales in probably 2010, 2009, 2008, but gave it up because it did feel there was no control and it did look like copycat, as you call it, marketing. It was go online, find, what was the ClickBank, find what the biggest seller was. Do you remember this?
Yeah.
ClickBank.
Whatever
the biggest seller was, rip off and duplicate. That was the expression they were using.
Yeah.
And then just do the marketing because you could track marketing throughout the whole of the internet and just create a clone of it. And then you would start finding, and I was like, that doesn't feel like a business to me. Shadily, it feels quite unethical to me, but maybe I'm just stuck in the past and I don't quite understand that because this is all transparent now, we should be able to behave that way. I don't know. But there's clearly that didn't sit well with you either.
Not at all. And it's actually exactly the same model. So what people were doing in affiliate marketing, looking to study the best sellers, break it apart, repack it with your own name and label on.
Yeah.
And flog it hard and wait for someone to come along and copy you. Pretty short runway on each one. It's the same with products. So people would look to see what the best selling product is. So not necessarily books. It could be some stationery. It could be a baby toy. It could be sports equipment. It could be anything that's sold through Amazon, even food. So people would study the best sellers. And at the time, there were things like kitchen gadgets for all the rage. So there would be some silicone baking sheets or something. And everybody would go out and sell these identical silicone baking sheets, all from the same factory. And it was just a big price war. It was a big race to the bottom. And I didn't like the look of that. So from the beginning, I pretty much ignored what everyone else was teaching.
On it how feels to be like this mob mentality could be going on. Help me understand this. Is it like that? It's this, the mob runs this way because that seems to be the way it's easier. And then they run this way because it's easier over there.
Yeah,
and if you're last in the mob, you're going to be last to get the results because basically it's like market forces, supply and demand. It's the emotional high is gone and then you turned up and it's too late.
Exactly that.
Okay, so I think I understand. So a lot of people would be doing badly.
Yeah, and there's a lot of people who are playing in that sort of mob mentality. They're following the whatever the best practice of the day is. You or I might not think that's best practice. But then there's this whole ecosystem that helps you have a bit more of an edge in your copycat model. So there'll be people that help you out launch or out advertise the other people with the same product as you, rather than time and energy into having a unique product.
Yeah.
So there's a whole ecosystem of all these services for Amazon sellers. It's a really bizarre little online society of there's millions of Amazon sellers. Huge, huge game.
Well, there's a huge amount of money. I mean, COVID, I know we're rushing ahead here, but COVID has forced us all online. I've never shopped online as much as now. And as much as I wanted to support local, my bookstore was quite unpleasant during COVID. It wasn't a pleasant buying experience. It was a very strange, I don't shop just to have a product. I want an experience. I want to feel that it matters that I'm doing it rather than I'm just filling time. So I wanted to support local, but their experience was so crappy. But I went on Amazon and books, obviously. I made sure I had books coming each week. There was a feeling of an experience around it, that it mattered. I'm thinking all around the world right now, people are being forced into their homes, needing to still shop, needing a different form of entertainment because now it's all within the home, not outside of the home. Amazon's only going to go gangbusters through the roof. And they're changing the landscape of buyer behavior. COVID is changing the landscape of buyer behavior.
Yeah. Amazon's growth was 44% year on year. They've just had their big earnings call. So huge year. And across a lot of different categories. So food, obviously all the health, personal care type wipes and sanitizing things. But people cooking at home, people buying bread makers or people starting a garden. Yeah, such a cliche. homeschooling, home exercise, you know, all those products just went gangbusters. Travel bags, not so much, but everything else, all on. No wheeled luggage.
No. Oh, goodness, yes. So I'm feeling there would have been this mob move, particularly last year, people starting to realise they had to run to get ahead of supplies of bicycles, like bicycles sold out in Australia.
Yep, same here.
Home exercise equipment sold out, and you couldn't get a container of that stuff. We tried importing a container of it because we're importers. We couldn't get it.
No.
So what was that like? We'll come to that because I do want to talk about what was it like for you last year and probably into this year, trying to pick where to place yourself amidst everybody starting to realize the game is now going to be online for the foreseeable future. So we'll get to that. So 2014, you started up and you did kindly tell me before the podcast, which I'm going to share with our viewers now, never ask someone who's made millions of dollars on Amazon what product they sold to make the millions of dollars. And the etiquette is, help me out here if I'm getting it wrong, is if I ask that, literally the conversation we just had will happen to you. And there will be a mob of people who will literally just copycat, rip off and duplicate, however they want to term it, and just create a clone of your site and everything you've done. How have I done?
That's spot on.
Has that been your experience?
Well, I was pretty naive. I trotted off to a conference in the States early on and I had my shiny little new business card with my name and my brand of my product. And this nice Kiwi girl I bumped into over there said, oh, you shouldn't hand that out. Don't tell anyone what you're selling. They'll copy you.
Wow. And has that happened to you?
No. Well, the thing is, anybody can copy a product on Amazon. It's very transparent because you can go online and see what's selling and you can see the reviews, you can see the images, you can see the price. You could put that into a search engine and find a factory on Alibaba that makes that thing. So it's not sort of seeing what's selling, it's that it's kind of everybody's going to build a portfolio and build a brand of products for a particular market. So I've launched over 1,000 different products, but none of them have been copied because the products I choose are much lower demand. So I'd much rather keep clear of all the competition and for that benefit, have a bit less volume, but that's just fine because there's all the drama and stress and aggro is around the highly competitive products. And that's where you see all the really grotty behavior that I just don't want to have to deal with.
What's an example of high demand product that you wouldn't touch? Let's do it that way.
Okay. So a yoga mat. If you wanted to sell a yoga mat, there's probably 680 pages of yoga mats that are going to come up on somebody's Amazon search before they find yours.
Okay. That's a great example. So the idea was when you went into it, you just looked where there wasn't as many pages for people to search.
Yeah, or where there might be a lot of volume of products for sale, but the quality of the competition wasn't high. So they didn't know what they were doing on Amazon. Maybe a company that's normally bricks and mortar high streets just have roughly and very scrappily uploaded their catalogue of products for sale, but it's not optimized with keywords or not nice images for Amazon customers. So I always look for products that are low competition where I know on pretty much day one, the day it goes live, I'm up with the absolute best of the top of page one of those search.
Why are you sure of that? Because that's not my experience with Google.
Right, I know. Well, Amazon's got a very sophisticated algorithm that's all about people spending the most money. So they really want that shopping dollar because they make about a third of the sale price in their fee. So they're very incentivized financially to have a good page one where people actually buy something. So if you've got products with bad reviews, you lose your page one spot. If you're in and out of stock all the time, you're not going to be on page one.
Right.
If your pricing's not great or your conversion rate's not great, you'll be down in the rankings. And 86% of the sales are off page one. So you're kind of on page one or die. You know, it's pretty hard to get ahead if you're on page 63. So I do research.
I've never been to page 63.
No, me neither.
I don't think I've been to page 6.
Yeah, it's that social proof. You trust the other Amazon customers, you trust Amazon, and you read the reviews on page one. And how long have you got? The kind of amount of dollars you're spending on an Amazon purchase, this isn't a 10-hour research project. This is a 1 or 2 or 5 minute job. You know, you need a poster or something. Yeah. So there's categories I keep clear of because they're inherently tricky, you know, electronics or dangerous things or tricky to ship things or very heavy items. But generally I'm looking for products where if I do some research, like I want a desktop candle, I might find it really, really competitive to beat the other people with a vanilla scented candle or something. But if I had something really special, you know, it was some Tasmanian tea tree and it, or it was soy based, or it was a kit to make a candle and it was a gift or something like that, it was a bit more premium, a bit more work had gone into producing the actual
I'm
product.
I'm hearing bespoke. Is bespoke what's, is a category?
No, so I don't do that sort of whole print on demand customized thing. Some people
sorry,
do.
By bespoke, I mean it's more it's more niche, like Tasmanian, whatever you call it. Yeah. It's a more niche.
Yeah.
It's narrow niche. It's all the way down to you've literally named the forest.
Yeah, organic, that's, free range, fair trade, all those sorts of things.
The tree has a name. It's that kind of feel. Is that where people...
Well, that might be a little bit too far for middle America average Amazon shopper, but I don't really mind if I miss the middle of the market. I just sort of want to catch that very top end and have the best product.
Fabulous.
So I've also got a high quality. My first product I can talk about a little bit. But my first brand was handmade in Nepal with New Zealand wool. So it was merino wool from New Zealand that was... the processing was done in Nepal and then they shipped these products off to the States. I mean, I sold something like $1.6 million of it in the first year. And it was like a product that met none of the criteria that any of the Amazon courses would teach you to sell. Not one of them. It wasn't from China. It wasn't mass produced.
Congratulations.
It was a charity. It was made by a charity.
Congratulations. That's awesome.
And it was a feel-good thing. It was a product I was proud of. The packaging looked lovely.
Sorry, you didn't name the product. So I'm picturing like it's a jumper or a throw or something. Like it doesn't matter. Let's us viewers together. Let's picture a throw or a jumper just so we can picture it. Did you have any concept when you sent out this hypothetical whatever jumper throw that this would be, what were you imagining your numbers would be?
Well, my target was to maybe make $4,000 a month profit, at which point it would be worth leaving the day job, letting the nanny go, and then I'd be better off staying at home with a little bit of a buffer.
Yeah.
Better than the day job.
Yes.
That was sort of, that made my world significantly better, quality of life day to day. That was a number that made a big difference to me.
Yeah.
So it went quite a lot better than that. I think one of those months in the run up to my first Christmas, the year I started, I think I did 250K US in a month.
Fabulous.
And I was thinking, dollops of cash. I was sitting at work one day and I'd made $33,000 in a day in sales and I was still at the day job just sort of sitting on my hands and not telling anyone because I think it's time to quit.
Yeah.
So I did quit. I think I stayed in the day job about 9 months. I kind of had
you were risk adverse.
Oh yeah, I was more of a beginner's luck, or maybe it'll all crash.
Maybe it'll end fast, or maybe supplier will dry up.
Yeah,
because it's not a business when it's one product.
No.
It's only a campaign. I always say to any business owner, it's not a business until there's more than one product, because otherwise it's just a campaign. If the campaign ends, you don't have anything.
Yeah.
So my numbers when I started I started in late 2003, so we'll just count 2004. My husband and I, JP, we went to a cafe and he said, it's time that you turned it around instead of you going to all these clients, have them come to you and start a coaching school. Right. So we did back of the napkin numbers. I've got the bit of paper somewhere. And my biggest dream that I could imagine was doing $360,000 in a year. That was it. That was the top of the range, pie in the sky, not conceivable, couldn't possibly, everything would need to align. But let's put it down anyway, number. That was the number.
Amazing.
Yeah. And it... Because when we start out, we don't understand the numbers. We don't understand scale. I didn't understand scale. I didn't understand the power of communication through marketing. And there are so many variables I didn't realize we could impact the lever points in the business. And I'm sure that was your experience in the first year.
Yeah, yeah. So because the first product had been so profitable, with great margins, and I still had the day job income, I was like, right, better get good at this fast and take it seriously. It's not a fluke. I can do this. So I launched a bunch of other products. So they were also from Nepal. I got products from India, Sri Lanka, Vietnam. I just did about 400 products in year one and figured out what worked and what didn't.
Well done.
So that was quite chaotic.
So you had a new baby, a job for 9 months into this. And
a toddler,
because you had a second child as well. and you weren't sleeping and you launched 400 products.
Yeah. I sold my horse. I had to let something go.
Okay. Yes. The dawn yeah. feeds and brushing and riding when you're just off 3 hours sleep.
No, that was the straw that was going to yeah. break the camel's back. But I had so much energy for the business. Every time I sat down to do it, it didn't feel like work. I was so excited. And you get yeah. such a quick feedback system through okay. selling on Amazon. It's, you know, the product's for sale. It lands in the Amazon warehouse. It doesn't come via me. It goes straight from the factory to Amazon. Yes. Amazon
so that's called drop shipping, isn't it?
No, not quite. So drop shipping, I wouldn't buy the inventory up front. I would only
yeah. order okay. I get a customer. So you paid for it up front?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so let's back up a little bit. How did you have the courage to put your money into a Nepalese product that you've never sold before that didn't meet any of the criteria for an Amazon success story?
Well, it was a little bit nerve-wracking because it was a sort of leap of faith. I had to wire money to someone I'd never met for a product yes. I'd never seen, to ship to the States, to Amazon, which I'd never dealt with. But it wasn't a huge amount of money. I think I ordered 75 units and they were less than $2 each. So it wasn't too okay. daunting because Amazon lets you start nice and small. They're quite happy for you to test. They charge you a monthly professional seller fee of $40 or $50 or so. But for that, you can send in 20 container loads or just one single product, one yes. unit. It's, you know, that's your ticket to play. So I started really small. And then halfway through, basically it landed, got an email from Amazon saying, congratulations, your product's in stock. My listing went live. It's like, oh, there it is. It's live. Something's worked. And then about 2 hours later, I had my first customer, somebody in Hawaii. And I got $20 of my balance on Amazon profit from that first product. And like that first $20 was more exciting than the millions later. That was it. That was the proof it yep. could do it. It would work. Yeah. It was real. Here we go. Wow. So exciting.
Oh, it's amazing. Yep. So you would have still felt the anticipation for every new product though. I can't imagine you get blasé because you're having to research and think it through and.
Yeah. And I get a lot more of my energy starting the new ones than seeing the older ones sort of optimize and settle in. Like it's nice to have those cash cow products that just keep yeah. on tracking.
Yeah.
I'm so excited with every new launch still.
Yes.
And I've done over 1,000, I think now. Yeah. I go to, there's an agricultural show in our local town here in New Zealand. And I was there last week and I bought a product off a lady. I was like, well, that would be good on Amazon. I said, do you want to sell these on Amazon? I can teach you, you know, I can either buy them off you in bulk yeah. or anything, but that's a great Amazon product. You would do really well with that on Amazon.
Yes. I often go to markets. I was at a market with my husband on the weekend by chance. We went for a really long, we did this beautiful walk. We drove the car far away and then walked back home, which is something we learned to do in the last 12 months. And there was by chance a market there and it was an artisan's market. And I was walking around assessing it from an online marketing perspective, comparing a day in the rain, thank you, Melbourne, with people, there would have been 20 people for 50 marquee tents of different products, all artisans,
yep,
versus billions of people, in any one day, millions of people online wandering past your booth.
Yep.
And I was trying to assess what would make it, candles are apparently huge, Sophie, can I just say?
Yep.
Candles are huge. I'm pretty sure you can make money in candles on Amazon. And I'm not an expert at all. Don't take that as advice. My God. But I was thinking, how do markets still continue? What is it about a market that's causing people to traipse all around the Victorian state and set up in Geelong and Torquay and then Anglesey and then here versus one location? And I asked them, are you online? And some of them, oh, no, we just prefer... What is the difference? What's the difference between the thinking of a market stall and preferring to shift locations for a $60 a week fee versus yeah. just sitting down in front of the computer?
Yeah, just that difference between cottage industry and is what you like or choose to do versus yeah. you want to run a business that can scale.
One of the guests we've got coming up in our podcast is Michael Gerber. He wrote the E-Myth Revisited.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And he taught me what we're discussing now, the difference between thinking technician, which you could have been, the cottage industry, just bring in whatever it was, the cap, the whatever, the hat, and then versus the manager of it, which is starting to think in terms of Amazon, you manage that, versus the entrepreneur level, which you've done, which is to do it across brands and across divisions and different categories. Yeah. I took that from him. And that's when I think about cottage industries and I think about market stalls, that's how I relate to it. This is somebody who prefers the technician aspects of it.
Yeah.
Whereas I don't believe that's you. And it is me. I very much enjoy the coaching session, the one-on-one.
Yeah.
As much as I enjoy the manager side of it where I teach other coaches, because I know you teach people to make money on Amazon, I do still enjoy the technician. I enjoy having clients. I enjoy getting with a small group and unpacking it. Like I can see myself at the market. Does that make sense? Like I would do coaching at markets. I feel that. Because I feel you're more definitely manager, entrepreneur, and more comfortable there. Is that how you see yourself?
Well, funny thing is, I love the market. And so I was in an airport somewhere and there was an advert in Singapore Airlines or someone, a one-page advert for the Delhi gift fair. So I went. So I now take clients. I think like pre-COVID, I was taking two trips a year to India to go hands-on, walk up and down thousands and thousands and thousands of booths with all the best handmade products out of India. And we did the same in Vietnam, same in Hong Kong. Just went to Germany this time last year. I was at the premium gift fair for like best products from all around the world in Frankfurt. So I love the hands-on with products thing with students, teaching them what to choose and what's good, what's not good.
I think you're still manager when you do that though. Like you're not, I sit there and create a coaching session. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I think you're next level to me. I take the credit. I think you are next level around it. Whereas I'd be at the market with a booth. That's what I'm saying. I'd have a booth and I'd want a coach. I love that time. I love the intimacy of that. Whereas you think differently and more strategically and more structured than I do. I think about it much more. I do the strategy, but I love getting just, if I didn't do strategy, I'd coach. Because I think you're very naturally a strategist.
Maybe it's through necessity as well, because I live in the middle of nowhere and I've got young children. So the business had to be built on a model that didn't rely on my hours all the time.
Yes.
But I do like thinking, but I also do like doing. I love contact time with students.
Yes.
But I'm introverted as well. So, you know, there's only so many hours I can give on high beam energy where the people back to back can't do that all day. And time zones and all these other things. It was almost designed to not have me do all the doing, but I do like doing the doing.
Wonderful. So there was happenstance as well as your willingness and energy to make this happen. How much do you think happenstance plays in someone succeeding in a business versus not? I'm sure there are plenty of people who's come to Amazon and just got burnt and might be even listening to this conversation thinking that's not it.
Yeah. No, I've had some good luck. You know, I was careful with the first product I started, and I started small. So even if the first one hadn't worked, I'd had a bit of, you know, energy and budget left to try a few more times if I needed to, but the first one was great. But I think a lot of it was just mindset, you know, just being a bit of a cynic is quite helpful when there's everyone saying, here's a blueprint, follow it, you know, like, don't know, if it's not a very sensible sounding blueprint, I might ignore it.
Yeah.
Or if this is what everyone else is doing and it's easy to copy, what's to stop someone copying me? Or, you know, in a real business, wouldn't you want some intellectual property or be able to protect your asset? What kind of business would I start? I mean, I used to do startup businesses for a university and, you know, we wouldn't go out and try and raise investment from venture capitalists for an idea where you were copying someone else from a factory that you couldn't protect the idea or the design or the product or the supply chain or nothing in it.
Yeah.
So there was some sort of first principles from business, some good negotiations with the suppliers. So I got really friendly with the suppliers. I was invited to weddings in Nepal and, you know, I had a really good relationship with my supply chain people.
Yeah.
They would give me tips for products. They'd tell me what was happening. And they're like, oh, you should sell these in Germany. All our retail people are going nuts selling these things. I should sell them on Amazon Germany. And they'd give me great tips. They'd be at trade shows and give me links to new friends they'd made who I should do business with. So my suppliers really looked out for me. That was a secret weapon, not sort of seeing the product as a cost center, but the supplier as a business partner who's on the ground, who knows way more than I will ever about the product and how it's made, who buys it.
There's so much there that you're doing though, in terms of your thinking. You are making it sound simple, and I'm just in awe and admire the way you've approached it, which I love. Building a business where it's built on the relationships and it's built on taking time with people and thinking through what's going to make it work. I think a lot of people might come to Amazon or any business and just fly into it hard and fast, thinking this has got to work, or I hope this works. You've put a lot more thought into it. And is that natural to you, or is that a skill you learned in your first year? Or
I definitely wanted to have a product I could be proud of. And so the extra work I did to make the product a bit special kind of kept everyone else away from it. So it was sort of in a bit of a class of its own for a long time. It then meant I could take my time. I didn't have people copying it. I've never had any of my products copied, touch wood. But there's a whole industry out there.
Bring it now. There we go. Got it.
Got it. There's a whole course out there, you know, teaching people how to copy other people's products by a thing called hijacking and pitching their reviews, and scantily. So I just don't have the time or energy for that. I just kept it. So I've had quality people, quality products, a little bit more time and effort in how they're presented, things that make it hard to copy. And
well, hey, let's just back up. My question was more about you've done pretty remarkable things. Was it natural to you to bring all of that care to it in that first year, or is that a skill you learnt in the first year?
I think that was more my nature of how I wanted to run my business. It was my first business I'd started. So I was taking each step and putting a bit of thought into each step and wanting to do it in a quality kind of way. So that bit did come naturally. Now when you start on Amazon, you kind of go, all right, oh, here's a piece of software that I can use to research an ideal product. It'll give me a green light and say, go, this product's perfect for you. And it'll scan all the Amazon data. And it gives people a false sense of security that because they've used this software tool, they're onto a winning product. But everyone else has got the same software tool saying, give me a really profitable, awesome product in this category. And it gives them all the right answers.
So I think that's it. I think the biggest trap people do when they go into business is they think, I found the shortcut. And we spend so much time from stage saying, if we had the shortcut, that's what we would have sold.
Yeah.
There is the work. There is the effort. I have yet to see the business that is a shortcut.
Yeah.
You can bypass lack of confidence, that you can bypass complete fear and procrastination. There's no business success at the end of those stories. We must deal with us to make this work. And you did that in your very first business. That's just fantastic.
Yeah, I had a very nice run-up into having my own first business, because when I worked for Victoria University in Wellington, I was there pretty much throughout most of my 20s. In the tech transfer office, so running startups that came out of the university. So there might be a license for a biotech company one week or a software startup the next, or some engineering things. So I was really lucky getting great exposure. You know, I was sitting in on board meetings of startups, and I saw a lot of small businesses start up fast on a pretty tight budget and go global really quickly, and, you know, watched a lot of what they did and how the CEOs ran them and what they paid attention to, what the board grilled them on, what the budget got spent on, how they wrote their business plans, how investors viewed those plans. And I did an MBA while I was there too.
Of course did.
I had a bit of a head start over some sellers perhaps, but it was a good
round. You had a head start because you cared about those conversations. I know you could have other people in the board meeting who wouldn't have heard a word of it. You clearly tune in and pay attention to it. I love that you're so keen for the learning. So I think everything you did before that precipitated it being possible for you, because you're very considered in how you've approached it. Whereas I know I could speak to somebody else, not that I ever have, who's successful on Amazon, and I wouldn't hear the same strategy. It's very thought through. I love that.
Well, thank you.
You were being strategic before you even knew what strategic was.
Yeah.
Because you didn't have the runs on the board yet. I love that. So what did your husband think of, or your friends and family think of you? I know what everyone thought of me going, you're going to be a coach. The first comment I got was, does anybody do that? I think I got that for a year. Does anybody ever hire a coach? From pretty well everybody. But my husband didn't. He was amazing. My family was great. But a lot of people were just like, really? People do that? What was it like for you in 2014?
Oh, well, I kept it very low key. I didn't tell too many people what I was doing. I had a close friend who's a designer. She helped me with all my packaging, so that was good.
Lovely.
My husband was busy working at PwC, so we're no longer married. That make the long game. So it was all very amicable, and we're still really, really good friends. But yeah, he was very supportive. It was definitely my gig, and it was a bit all consuming, and it definitely came at a price how hard I drove that business.
Yes.
I didn't have a sort of a breakdown or anything, but I was right on the edge. A few little peaks of, you know, peak crisis. I mean, there's always things that go wonky and topsy-turvy in business. Like some of those sketchy holding on by the fingernail moments were pretty hairy, and I wouldn't choose to be out at that level again for fun. It was, you know, good learning what I can tolerate stress-wise, and I never got into any financial holes. But you're just at the mercy of some Amazon rules someday. You know, something, you've done everything right and something goes wrong, and you've just got to, as a business owner, realise, oh, that's why not everybody does this.
Yes.
Yeah. It's not for everyone.
I think uncertainty and ambiguity is what unravels most people the most.
Yeah.
It's not being able to withstand the amount of uncertainty business environments serve up to us.
Yeah.
Do you think, is that what you think?
I completely agree. I mean, here in New Zealand, we've had borders closed for pretty much exactly a year. It's worth talking today. I mean, there's tourism operators in Queenstown desperate for the Australians back. And, you know, we've just had another announcement, oh, we'll give you a date for the Trans-Tasman bubble in another few weeks. I mean, they're just slipping away.
Yes.
There was a survey last week saying a third of them will be gone within 3 months.
Yes. Yeah. I did a master's, finished it last year, and we had a guest speaker, a so-called future strategist, a future thinker.
Yep.
And they really annoyed me. They said, this was prior to COVID, and COVID literally hit 2 weeks later. I can't believe the serendipity of his poorly chosen phrase when he said, tourist operators, for example, need to have a plan B.
When there's no tourists.
No matter what happens, you okay, so what do? Just all switch to Amazon selling? So suddenly people all have the ability just to switch industries on a dime?
Use the helicopters for a school bus? I don't know.
We're asking for a level of flexibility and adaptability in people that even the best and hardiest, and if you've invested every cent of your entire retirement fund, you sold your two houses in Melbourne, for example, you've moved up the coast, Queensland shuts down here in Australia, and every sense in that, you're not suddenly pivoting into a new industry, futurist. That's a really harsh judgment from somebody who I believe is getting paid comfortably to have views with no experience. That's an ivory tower comment. It really annoyed me, the lack of compassion in it, that all of everybody had to have a plan B. The world stopped, and just to just do something else when they put everything into it, and they're pulling their kids out of the schools. And I just thought we need a lot of compassion in this time.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm imagining during that first year, compassion, self-compassion wasn't high on your list.
No, but I have really switched this. I'm like
the most
militant person now about self-care.
Yeah, I have a feeling it's something, I just sensed it was something you learned.
Yeah,
but from what you said that first year, it was really about just get the business going no matter what. What do you think paid the price in that first year?
Well, health-wise, it was okay. Marriage was tough.
Yeah.
So we sold the first business. So my first brand was flying. I mean, it was absolutely cranking. And I've got an Australian friend who's a business broker, lovely Jock Pirtle, who's got digital exits. He's over in the States now. And I said, oh, Jock, what do you think this little Amazon brand of mine would be worth? He said, I'd get you $1 million for that tomorrow. He said, I'd get you a seven-figure buyer. So I sold it. So like, right, well, we'll pay off the mortgage in Wellington. Yeah. We went to Bali for 3 months. We're like, cool, we can relax.
Yeah.
Have fun again. And the children were 2 and 4 at this stage. And then we're like, where would we live if we could live anywhere in the world? Because now we don't need day jobs. Mm. And now we're like, Wanaka, that's where we live. So we live in Wanaka now. But I just sort of kept going. I didn't really have an off switch. You know, the handover of the business took off. Then I had clients I'd picked up to run their Amazon brands for them. They were quite demanding.
Yeah.
And then I started a bit of coaching, and then I was just always doing more and more products. So the whole thing was sort of snowballing and getting quite big and quite fast. And so the marriage ended 3 years ago, and we're still really good friends, really close. Very amicable in every way, but I just think the business sort of changed my identity, and I just sort of took off at high pace into a whole new world that I really enjoyed. And it took me, it was a really big transition in how I lived, and juggling it with the children's been really tough.
It would have shifted your identity of you.
Yeah. So a huge shift, because I'd been an employee in government. I'd been in the Foreign Office, where you are completely behind the scenes, just churning out big papers, doing analysis.
And risk adverse. And the ambiguity didn't cost you anything. It wasn't your ambiguity to experience.
No, 12 people voting on every decision, not just one person on the fly making it up as they go. So a big difference in style, workflow, the skills I needed. Turns out I didn't need to write really long emails all day every day. Brilliant. No big reports, no meetings. It was a really efficient way to work. So I really thrived on that pace and quite fast paced.
Yes.
And this online business, I was just like, these are my people. This is it. Yeah. This is, like, I can do this really well. So just threw myself at it.
Yeah. And did you feel like close to burnout? Because I'm not hearing self-care in that first year. I know in my first year or 2 years, self-care and me did not meet for 2 years.
No, I think I would have been a year and a half. So the trip to Bali was the thing that was like, deliberate, right now it's time to stop. So I went to yoga for 90 minutes every morning for 3 months. And I went to kind of a CrossFit thing and was in the sea a lot. And then came back to Wanaka, got a horse again. Was running. I always kept running, actually. I never stopped getting exercise, but it was just that sort of mental thing. I tried meditating. I'm rubbish at meditating. I just need to run. So I ran this morning. Yeah. Brain's in a great state when I get fresh air and exercise time on my own. Either on the horse or out running is sort of what I need.
Yes.
Yesterday we went boating with the children. So it was a long weekend here. So we went off to a lake with the boat and had a day water skiing and stuff. And that was nice, but I didn't get a sweater. I didn't get time on my own. It was a lovely day out. But today I was itching to go for a good long run on my own.
On your own.
Mm. Yeah. So I listened to a podcast or an audio book and just hours fly by. I just love it. And if I don't get that, I'm useless. I'm cranky and crabby and can't think straight and can't concentrate. So I've got a much better routine now. So kind of intermittent fasting mostly, and exercise in the morning mostly. Yeah. In the winter, I have to ride a bit later because the ground's frozen. But generally work, exercise first. Good coffee, you know, get the kids off to school, start the day nicely, and then do some work in the middle of the day. And then I'm clear by 3 to have the afternoon with the children and go and do all their various activities. And
my first two years, I did not do anything self-care. Now the list for self-care is shockingly long and fabulous, but it wasn't about everything outside of me that had to be created took all my energy and all my effort and all my focus and all my ability. I was maxed out every single day on my skill sets.
Yeah.
For 2 years, I didn't have a day where I felt everything was within my skill set.
No.
There was a learning trajectory to be had every single day.
Yeah.
And until that stopped, I didn't reintroduce self-care. I'm not advocating that. I'm just saying that's how it was for me. It worked. It was great, because then when I started realizing, oh, there's a me in this, after 2 years, it was like I came out of the fog. Oh, wow, I exist. I'm a person separate to the business. What does that mean? And started creating really self-care habits. But until my skill set could catch up with the day, I didn't allow myself, and I'm not justifying it, I'm not suggesting it, I didn't allow myself the space for me in it, because any effort wasted, it felt like, on how I was, was a moment I could have put into learning the skill I needed for the moment.
Yeah.
You relate to that?
Exactly the same. Yeah. And there's so many inputs in a day at that stage, and you need to match it with as many outputs. I mean, there's not a space to breathe. You're just churning.
Yes.
Very spinny and sort of like a sugar high. It's not a grounded quality way to work. It was not, didn't enjoy it. Well, I did in some ways.
I did.
I was on a permanent high.
Yeah.
As high as a kite. I mean, I was like, full beam, all day, every day. Couldn't sleep at night. It was just like, woo.
Couldn't sleep. Didn't need to sleep. Too excited. Too many ideas.
I loved it. But
yeah, it was fantastic. But it's not sustainable. It was the way I teach it. It's the rocket ship that needs to get free of gravity. It needs a lot of energy in the beginning. And then you're finally free. You can float a little bit. You need to burn all the fuel for the first few miles. Then after that, you burn hardly any fuel. That's how it was for me.
Yeah. Actually, that's a great analogy.
That's how it felt for the whole time. I was just hanging onto this rocket ship, flying. What's today?
I wouldn't push that work routine on my worst enemy, and it would be inhumane. You'd never be able to employ someone and ask them to do.
I couldn't do it again. No. I often think about starting a new business because I like startups and I enjoy it, but I'd approach it so differently these days. I'd be more considered and things would happen more slowly. But now I know what the skill that's required, and I can kind of predict within the ambiguity some of the pathways, whereas before I knew none of the pathways in through the ambiguity. It was all just ambiguous until I'd done it. And then I look back and go, oh, okay, now I know. But everything was ambiguous every day. Do you remember that?
Yeah, yeah. And you didn't know quite who to trust. Like, I know who's who now. If I had to start again, I could have half a dozen conversations and be on the fast track.
Yes.
And I'd have more resources to put behind it. And I've learned how to learn faster, and I've learned what catches people out in different situations a bit more. So I'm always slightly sick, but I'm really interested in how people screw up. And like the stories about people who lost everything, or, you know, bet the house on black or whatever, you know, like the learnings from other people's mistakes, I find them just as interesting as people's success stories. Like, I've got more of a fear of losing everything than greed for gaining twice as much again.
That's the human condition. That's literally how we're wired. Yeah. We want to keep what we've got rather than get the new.
Yeah.
It's very, very natural.
Yeah. So I kind of feel like I'm really well positioned now. I've got some good skills, good sort of base. Really
so you would feel a lot less ambiguity. You're like me now in business. There's a lot less ambiguity to play the game we've chosen to play.
Yeah. Standards, who we deal with, how we work, what's reasonable.
How to navigate uncertainty. I can bring a lot more now of calmness, and I know the questions to ask. I feel pretty confident now that I can handle it not going perfectly and learning from it and adapting. Whereas those first 2 years, I'm hanging on. I said, please work out, please work out, please work out.
Well, this podcast is such a great format. Podcasts are brilliant, but the people like getting, you know, the kind of guests you're getting on your show, it's just amazing. Like, people want to share what they've learned and, you know, share
that. It's so generous. Just every single guest. That's not true. There's one guest we're not showing the podcast of. It won't make it to air, and that's okay. And it's been a discussion, but for everybody else, they're just so generous and open and want to share what they know. And the messages are I'm seeing patterns in the messages, Sophie. This idea of being able to handle and tolerate ambiguity and uncertainty to figure our way through it and to give ourselves the time and the space to develop the skills in the ambiguity is how we grow. And through that growth, we can start getting some runs on the board. But I think a lot of people, too many people, won't face that ambiguity and won't face the not knowingness. Yeah. Whatever that is, it's the ego or the worry about looking bad or self-conscious, whatever. Yeah. Label it whatever you want. That's a game changer. You didn't do that in your first year. Mm. That's a piece of the DNA that I don't know if we can just give to everybody just because they want it. No. There is something about what you did in your first year that's you, very uniquely you.
Yeah, because anyone who wants to be an entrepreneur, you need a certain amount of EQ and IQ and grit, but you also need something else where you're just willing to throw yourself at it and figure it out as you go. And
not even know what it is, just know you're throwing yourself at whatever's coming. I don't know what that is. There's a light. I've got to run to that light. I don't know what it is yet, but I know that's where I'm heading. And you can't even see the rocks because the tunnel's pitch black. That's entrepreneurship in the first year.
Yeah.
Isn't that a beautiful picture? This is definitely a motivational speech.
It.
But it's true. It's true. Anybody who's selling any other idea that it happens in a weekend and all you got to do is just do a few hours of study. No, it's not. Because the moment you make, and how bad was it for you when you did your first hire? My first hire was, she was so off put by me and my manner. Oh, I was so embarrassing. I've got the power to edit. So if I don't like saying this afterwards, I'm editing, but it was so bad. My first hire, she left and left her handbag behind.
Oh. Wow. Well, I can tell you that my first proper hire, so I had a virtual assistant doing a bit of admin, but my first hire was someone you trained, Christine Berry.
Oh,
who's
wow.
Head coach. And
that's amazing.
She's a really good offset. So my skills and hers are completely different.
Yeah.
And she's a brilliant communicator. She's really patient. She's a great teacher. She's got a really good eye for Amazon products as well. So she was a client of mine.
Yeah.
I really liked her. She turned up to these regular group classes. She was on, she'd done the homework, she was just totally getting it. She's a great girl. In the same time zone, I was like, oh, you could help me. You know, I've got these clients who need some help with
that. She's kind, she takes care of people.
Yeah, very soft.
Fabulous.
Yeah.
So our first hire decisions have nothing in common.
No, but Christine's still with me, you know, 5 or 6 years later probably now.
Wonderful. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
No, so great. If someone's going to start out in Amazon, so rather than, so we're not going to go into how to choose products or anything like that, what kind of time would you need to set aside? What would your thinking need to be? I don't even know how to approach it or think about it. So if, what would you say to me if I was going to, I'm not, goodness, look at Amazon as a potential marketplace for something?
Yeah. So that's a really good question. So I probably explain this to people all the time, but the way I'm going to explain, you know, I'm just going to go right back to how I thought about it the very first time I approached it and what I did and how it worked. And so the sort of three steps, one is get your head around how Amazon works. What do Amazon customers look for? How do the Amazon pages look? I mean, what are people buying and why do they choose the products that are selling? So figuring out how Amazon functions, because it's such a huge platform. If you understand a little bit how Amazon's thinking when they design the page, how customers think when they shop, that's a good sort of foundation, which if you're in Australia or New Zealand, we might not really understand. Americans do this all day, every day. But start there, understand how the platform works. So that's, you know, a few weeks of browsing around. And then you need to understand how individual products are performing on the platform. So that's learning how to research different products selling on Amazon, and there's various research tools you can use to see what's selling. You can figure out their profit margins, you can see which categories have got different compliance or extra shipping trickiness or packaging challenges. So really thinking about the practicalities of getting a product to that marketplace, which Amazon will then sell for you. And then the third piece, once you've had a good look at all those products and picked one that you like the look of to sell for yourself, is how to source it, like how to find the right supplier, how to negotiate with them, how to do international shipping and international business with a supply chain where something's made in India or China, goes via sea or by air, ends up in a warehouse in the States. And then there's a bit of marketing, but really I like the products that don't need heaps of pushing and promotion and marketing. Amazon's a great big search engine. I want to just use the power of Amazon's algorithm to make my product pop up on top rather than sell something really competitive and have to do Facebook ads and video ads and YouTube channels to promote that product. I'd rather have lots of products selling 5 or 10 units a day than 1 or 2 blockbusters that I've got a whole gang of marketing people pushing hard. Because all that marketing eats into your margins really quickly too.
Yes,
so
it does.
I like low maintenance, low drama, products that don't keep me awake at night.
Yeah.
I've got a big list of criteria and sort of a matrix for assessing a product idea, which keeps me a bit structured because naturally I'm not at all structured. And then that's generally kept me pretty right. So the worst case scenario is if you buy a product for $2 that you've researched and you think you could sell it for $20, if it turns out not to be a winner, and some of them just won't be winners, you can at least usually get your $2 back and sell it at cost. So the downside's not too low.
Love it.
The upside can be really high. So it's never that scary choosing a product. The tricky bits, you know, you've got 5 really good looking products. Which one do you pick? How do you sequence them? Or how do you juggle the cash flow? Because this model with Amazon, the beauty is the really high margins and the low maintenance of it. But you've got to buy the product up front. So you've got to actually be decisive. If you sit around spinning for 12 months waiting for the perfect product, you don't have an Amazon business. But there's a little niggle or something with every single product. You're like, oh, I wish I could just make that margin a bit higher, or I'm a bit worried about that shipping thing, or a bit of competition there, a bit more than I'd like. The only way to ever get the real data is to launch your own products, not rely on other people's reports or software tools. The only one that matters is your product and how it performs. And all those other tools.
What does that mean? Sorry, I heard what you said, but it didn't quite click with me, so.
Okay, so say I'm researching pens I could sell on Amazon. I can look at research tools that tell me how much money other pen sellers are making, but I'm going to have a slightly different pen to all of those. And I can extrapolate some of their data and I can read reports and I can see what the best selling pens are doing. But the only way I'll ever know how many pens of mine I'll sell is if I start selling them. I can't sit on the sidelines and use research tools and spreadsheets to figure out if my pen's going to sell or not. I just have to put it up for sale, which means I've got to spend some money up front to put it to ship in a bunch of them, and then I'll see.
But so I'm picturing with this strategy, you're getting me calmer about selling on Amazon. So kudos, because you know, I turned up as a dinosaur, and here I'm thinking, you've broken that down. I can actually do each of the steps you just said. What I couldn't do is look at Amazon and think about what to sell. But the steps you've given me, I could do each of those steps.
Yeah, you could.
I am really thinking you must be very good at supply chains, because it isn't as simple as putting a pen on, because then you've got to shore up, you test with 10 pens or 20 pens, great. But then you need 20,000. So you need a supply chain. You must be very good at building supply chains.
I hired someone to help me with that, because I'm not naturally very organized, but there is a spreadsheet called the order book, and it says what shipped when it's due at which port. The relationship building with the suppliers, I still do. Like, I do the initial outreach to get quotes. A lot of Amazon sellers outsource all of that, but I quite like to choose who I'm doing business with.
Okay, yeah.
And it's part of the product design. And actually, do you know, my best-selling product at the moment is from Queensland, Australia.
Fabulous.
Lovely chap who got a bit screwed by some of the supermarket contracts.
Oh,
and he's
course.
A quality product, and I'm the only person that sells it on Amazon.
Oh, how so wonderful.
Nice.
But well, that's him adapting as well. What I like about that, it's also him adapting, which is, you know, what we keep being told to do, and he's done that. That's fantastic.
Yeah. So that was a great product. And then I've got some from New Zealand and places like that. But even, you know, the ones all around Asia, who I'm not going to meet all of them in person.
No.
I do get to know them pretty well, and we tweak the product design, and I talk packaging with them, and I get them to give me some ideas and find out who else.
All before you launch it.
Yeah.
I like how thoughtful you are with it.
Oh, thank you. Well, that sort of comes quite naturally, but I know some of that's also cultural, like New Zealanders and Australians too. We're not too intimidating, and we're kind of trading countries. We're used to doing business in the West, and we're used to looking east to do business there too. Like, we're in the middle, we're kind of neutral, we're not threatening, haven't got big egos, we don't turn up, I'm the CEO, give me your best price and I'll beat you down on price. You know, we want to have a relationship. So I think I've noticed my Aussie and Kiwi clients, we seem to find this bit quite easy. In other countries, they like freak out, how do I talk to a supplier? Like, we just pick up the phone. We're used to small companies where everyone does a bit of everything. It's not, there's not a massive power distance between the person who's on the phone asking for a quote and the CEO who owns the business. I mean, we're just quite happy to talk to anyone.
What just came to mind for me, what's the name of that big department chain in America? The low, good, challenging, like really good priced one.
There's a Walmart. Walmart,
that's it.
The cheap one,
Have you heard about the Walmart? Is this true, what I've heard about the Walmart process, trying to get a product on a Walmart shelf? That they have rooms, like interrogation rooms, down the corridor. You go into the room, the buyers sit opposite you and try and screw you for the very, very, very best price they can. And it's just this market of just you're in, you're out, you're in, you're out. And then I hear this approach, I know I'm heading more towards being an Amazon seller than trying to get anything into Walmart. Obviously, you get into Walmart, you've got any margin, you're going to be okay.
Yeah.
But the process seems quite dehumanizing to me.
Oh, yeah. I haven't heard that story, but...
apologies to Walmart if it's not true. I did hear it from someone wanting to put something in Walmart, so hopefully it wasn't just hearsay and they've made it up, but that is how they described it.
Yeah, I looked into it, and obviously there's some big volumes there, and it's a nice way to diversify. If you've got a good product on one platform, then maybe there's another channel for it. So I looked into it pretty seriously, but if you're not based in the US, the compliance and paper trail is a bit hard for me to...
Well, if you ever get that far, you need to text me and let me know. Was there interrogation rooms?
I don't like low margin.
A plain table and chairs, and that was it in the room. And it was just next, 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 next. I was like, oh my God, I would find that a very difficult place to be. Whereas Amazon, I'm feeling it's got more creativity. Am I right?
Yeah. I love the creative side of it. Yeah. So you can have ideas around how you design your product, or even what to sell, how you package it, how you present it, who uses it and how they use it, how you brief the photographers to do the images for it. You know, it's quite visual, because people are shopping as a visual experience. They're not tasting. So I used to sell tea. So they couldn't taste my tea, but they could see the packaging. They could read the store. They could see which part of the world it was grown in, and that it was fair trade and heavy metal free. And
it's how I make my decision to buy tea. I want all that criteria met. So I am hearing this really tailor-made approach to your products. It would really suit me as a buyer, because you're taking care of the things I'm thinking about. I want organic. I want the it to be sourced somewhere that matters and that's being ethical. And the list goes on. I think there's a lot of buyers like me now.
Yeah, and pretty packaging goes a long way when people are buying just off a picture on the phone.
Golden Blend stopped making the best turmeric tea ever, and we started on it because of the black and gold branding. I was like, and then they stopped. So what would you recommend to somebody who's getting started? Because there's no way there's not a bunch of people hearing this thinking, Sophie has made this seem doable.
Well, I think the key thing is definitely to do a low volume product that you know exactly who's going to buy it, and it's got low competition, and then you've got a chance at some good sales to get started. If you go into something that's already really crowded and it's full of really aggressive marketers and they've whittled down to the last cent of profit fighting each other, and then there's some background marketing behind those sell prices, I mean, it's just ugly. You're not going to win. It's just a big bottom, and it's really sort of intimidating. I mean, I once got a bit too big for my boots. I just had a check for $1 million selling an Amazon brand. And I had this idea I was going to do this particular type of product. So I went big on it. I filled a container. It's like, I can do this. I know all the tactics. I've been to all the masterminds and know exactly how to sort of beat everyone.
Yeah.
And it was awful. And by the time I'd spent, you know, a fortune and hours of time trying to promote it, there was nothing left.
Oh, wow. So I went just happy to unload it. Just get rid of it.
I sold it at cost. Yeah. It was actually a product that I thought, I'd been at the Canton Fair in China, and the minimum order for this product was a 20-foot container. It's like, oh, that's good. That'll put off all the other smaller players. It's been me. Like, it'll be a much smaller pool, even though the other people selling this will be a bit more together. There's not going to be too many of us. I think I can nail it. So I did a better job than all of them on the packaging and the messaging, and but it was still pretty much a standard product inside. And that was my lesson there.
So you didn't trust your original skill set. You've moved into a different... space.
But it was a great product, and it was just, it had to have such a big initial order that you couldn't do a test run. So now I'm like always a test run. If you can't do a test run, it doesn't happen.
So love it. That's really sound, solid way to think about it. I love that. So you've sold a couple of businesses, is that right?
Yeah. So I sold two of
the brands. Good success story. So share with us what you've done.
So the first brand was about 18 months old, and I was just doing my tax year end things, gone through my box of receipts.
Yeah.
You can imagine, sort of systems person that I am not. And got everything ship shape, had all the numbers together, and thought, oh, this is pretty interesting. I wonder if I could sell it. So as I mentioned earlier, this guy Jock, who's a broker in the States, got me a buyer pretty much the next day. He's like, I'll get you a seven-figure buyer for that business. It's great. So okay.
Wow.
And so that was a quality moment, you know. Just suddenly got $1 million. So we went to Bali. Then I built another business and sold that for a few $100,000. And then I've got a bunch of products I'm playing around with and brands I'm building now. I'm also doing some ebooks, which has been a fun project. So last year during lockdown, when we were all thinking how we're going to do things differently, some of my Indian suppliers' factories closed for a few months, and that was fine. You know, I had plenty of stock on some things. The Australian stuff kept shipping. Most of my products were fine. Most of my Indian stuff was fine, but just one or two were quiet. And I was like, oh, what could I do that's different? So I'd written a few books on Amazon about how to sell on Amazon, very meta. And then I thought that was pretty easy and fun and fast and profitable. And then I looked at, I always keep an eye out on Amazon businesses for sale because I like to see what everyone else is selling and what multiples they're getting. So I know when it's my next turn, what the timing and pricing and stuff should be. So I'm on a few email lists, and this one came through with an ebook business for sale. So I bought it during lockdown. I was like, well, I can learn how to self-publish books, like not ones that I've written, but actually create a sausage machine of ebook production.
Yeah.
List them on Amazon. I know Amazon. I know everybody's buying books about homeschooling or sourdough bread or how to be an Amazon seller or how to be a cryptocurrency trader. Yeah. I mean, everyone's buying everything for Kindle during lockdown and buying books. So I started doing ebooks and books on Amazon last year as well. So that's been a whole new game, and that's been really successful and fun so far. So I bought four businesses last year.
Congratulations.
So I sold two Amazon brands, bought four very little ebook businesses, basically not even businesses, just old Amazon accounts that had some ebooks in them that I could play with and learn with.
Yeah.
And then I hired someone and produced sort of 30 books a month. Just did the research exactly as to products, research what topics people are interested in, where's their demand. next step, what's already too competitive? You know, I'm not going to try and outdo somebody where I've got no expertise, and you really need to be a medical doctor or a day trader to write on that topic. But, you know, all the general stuff, how to grow a container garden. I can outsource the writing of that if people want to know about how to start a container garden.
And then you
pay a few $100s and the book turns up in your inbox and you load it up to Amazon and start selling it. So that's been really fun. I've been on an absolute roll with that game. So that's been super. But
that
it's the same
fun.
Strategy as Amazon. Yeah, there's no shipping as well, because during lockdown, shipping was chaos. So I was like, right, it here's an amazing chance to do some other fun stuff.
There's, and the like, price of container shipping now has gone up. 100 It's gone from $700 to $5,000 a container to ship. It's just insane. And if you can get a container out of China, because of course all the containers are landing here and not having anywhere to ship to.
Yeah.
So we're having issues.
Ports are chaos. And even the raw materials getting to the factories are chaos.
Yes.
It's a bit hard.
Yeah.
Congratulations. So it was to have another look at another game, but it's related. It was easier. It's like a tenth of the complexity of doing a physical product, doing an ebook.
Wow.
So that's been great fun. Been enjoying
and
that a lot.
We started the conversation earlier and then we said we'd come back to it. Around COVID, clearly things must have got better, I'm guessing, for anyone who was online. Can you talk a little bit about who did well and why during these times?
Pretty much every category on Amazon grew a lot. Yeah. So some categories, anything healthcare related, massive, sports, home equipment for sort of health and fitness type things, massive. The books all grew really massively. Kitchen and cooking things, home decor, people setting up home offices. I mean, things were cranking like 2 or 5 or 10 times normal sales in some months.
If you could get the product.
So there's Chinese New Year, and you know, there's just a few lurchy bits that, you know, keep you on your toes during the year.
Yeah.
So most of the sellers I know, most of my students did really, really well in the last year. They've had a great run. And Amazon.
Do you think it's ever going back? Do you think it's ever?
I think this is the start of a big boom. So there was some report out saying, you know, the growth of e-commerce shopping over the last 12 months has been what had been predicted for the next 5 years. It's just all kind of concertinaed in. And we're over that hump where people trust that they've had a good experience. It's turned up on time. Their credit card didn't get ripped off. The things weren't all broken. They were like how they looked in the picture. You know, everyone's got that much more confidence in online shopping.
The packaging meant things don't get damaged when they arrive, which happened years ago. Now it arrives as it looks, which is fantastic.
Yeah. And Amazon's really, they've only really got one philosophy, which is about the customer experience. So if the sellers do anything that jeopardizes the customer experience, you get kicked off as a seller very quickly. Low tolerance for over-exaggerated claims, you know, overly flattering photography. You know, they're really strict on that stuff, which is good. It keeps it very fair.
And it makes it possible for you to know the landscape you're operating within. Versus another business that you might go into, you don't know the landscape and you don't know how to operate because you don't know the landscape. Whereas Amazon, you know, you can learn the landscape.
Yeah, very clear.
So everybody's operating on the same landscape. I think that's a really good place to start if someone hasn't had a business before.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you try to start, say, Facebook ad business, you know, an agency for the people, the rules change every day. And then the tactics that work, everybody does bot messenger or something, but then everybody does bot messenger. And then the impact that those individual messages used to have then start getting ignored, or the videos start getting ignored, or the quizzes start getting ignored, or whatever the latest rage is. You've got to be so nimble and you've got to spend a fortune to stay up with what's working and set the time to study it and then implement it and retrain the team.
Really? And then the rules change and there's no landscape anymore.
And no warning. I mean, neither does Amazon. If Amazon wants to hike their fees, they'll just tell you this is the new fee for something. But I mean, on Google, when they changed that SEO algorithm and everyone got, you know, they were doing all sorts of dodgy stuff. They're doing like white font on the white background with all the keywords. Dodgy stuff. But people lost everything overnight. Mm. Whereas on Amazon, I think if you play straight, it feels pretty safe and stable. It's the most safe and stable online business I can find.
Yeah. Well, congratulations what you've done.
Thank you, Sharon.
I think it's tremendous.
Thank you.
Where can people, is there anything I should have asked you that I haven't? Because I am a novice to this conversation and I'm sure, You also have, well, I would like to ask about your educational program that you have, because you teach people how to do this. So I obviously would love to know where we can send people, because there will be people listening thinking, I've at least got to look at this. But what haven't I asked you that I probably would need to ask you to help people understand Amazon better and how to do it?
I think you've covered all the important things, actually. I'm just quickly scanning through. There's nothing glaring that's missing. I mean, I could talk about Amazon all day. I'm really passionate about it.
Good.
And I love that. Really enjoyed it. I think one thing is it's been really fun. I've had some really wonderful life experiences. I've had great opportunities to travel. I've been through Sri Lanka, India, Vietnam, Hong Kong, UK, Germany, France. You know, I've zipped around the world thanks to this business. Conferences in the States. I've met some really smart people. I did those speaking tours around Australia pre-COVID. They were, you know, really fun to get out on the road. So had great travel, met great people. New business partnerships have come out of it. And I feel like the skills I've learned in this are really transferable. Like I feel, you know, as we've talked a lot about today, there's a lot of insecurity and ambiguity in what's coming up in the world. I feel like the skills that being an Amazon seller gives you makes you pretty versatile and relevant in today's world. You know, it's online, it's supply chains, that East is always going to manufacture stuff for the West for the foreseeable future. If you can have any useful role, whether it's shipping or I don't know, anything, sourcing, anything in that industry, selling online, educating customers for, you know, through online marketing, anything that you learn through Amazon seems to be really relevant and really in demand and well-paid skills. So it's given me a nice sense of security. And then the people that do it, it's quite sort of self-selecting. There's a whole internet marketing industry that you'll know as well as I do. You know, there's a lot of bro kind of really aggro marketing and lots of copycat stuff. But I find that the people that have been attracted into my program, and I'm sure it's, you know, well, I know for a fact it's the same with the people that turn up in your world and the coaching institute. You know, we attract nice people that want to do a quality job and want to learn the right way and invest a lot in themselves.
They bring humility to it. I really love that we bring humility to it and we're willing to learn. And you're right. I got, before we it became not possible to fly to America, I used to fly over and join the same masterminds. And I actually stopped because of this bro mentality. These young guys, and it's nothing against a young guy, for goodness sake. I'm generalizing massively. In these groups with this 60 people only, it's not the planet. Just, there was no to and froing. There was no exchange or an openness to it. It was very much based on, I'm doing it. I'm like, this isn't going to create anything meaningful for me. This is a long way to fly to lack any sense of meaning. So we pulled out. And now we really are just looking for the quality connections. It's got to be meaningful. They've got to be open. There needs to be a transparency about it, a generosity of spirit. That's who we want to hang out with. And I think that's who you attract as well.
Yeah. I mean, I giggle when I see all the Facebook ads pop up in my feed for all the other people that, you know, do Amazon or other e-commerce things. You know, it's all, they're posing with their Lamborghinis. I drive a Fiat 500.
There is a company, I don't know if they're operating now. I don't know if they're operating now because obviously people aren't allowed to fly. But in America, there, you probably know this. There is a company that you can hire a studio set and it's a jet and a Lamborghini.
Oh, I think I know everyone who's used it.
You would.
Ghastly. It's
I couldn't believe it. People feel that that's the thing to do.
But it turns me off. Like I run a mile. If I see that, I go, oof. It's like when a real estate agent's selling a house in the in some red blingy Ferrari or something. Like you just want the people that are the hard workers who are relatable and what they've done feels achievable, like that sort of girl next door kind of, you know, if they can do it, I can do it feeling. Whereas, you know, I just can't relate to a lot of those guys. It's not
back
like
in the day when I was being taught how to pitch from stage, so I'd sell as you do pitch products from stage. I was told by American pitch experts to spend at least 15 minutes talking about your successes and have I'm cringing saying it, and have photos up of your big house. I can't even keep the sentence going right now. It's causing me so much stress and anxiety. Look at me fidgeting around.
So stretched.
And I just can't bring myself into that world where that's what people are going to assess about me in terms of their criteria as to whether or not we should work together. Firstly, you don't be this long in any industry and not have done well. So that should be a criteria. Yeah. But flashiness as a criteria, I literally felt my breath just shorten thinking about it, that that would be anything that matters. Personally, I think it's so personal how I invest my money and things like that. Like, 'cause I do have a flash car by anyone's definition, but I'm not putting a photo of it up before I, oh my God, this is so uncomfortable. You know what I'm trying to say? I almost have to bow from the conversation because the ickiness of it.
Yeah.
Because I do have that, but I'm not going to put it there and it's just, if that's how people are criterioning me, we're not a match.
No.
We're a match for way other reasons than how I spend my money. That can't be what we think about. Yeah. But that's what I was taught. They wanted me to do 15 minutes of photos of holiday destinations. And we went to hire an Instagram brand manager. We went to some advice on social media the other day. We didn't end up working with them. They said, you're going to have a camera with you all day, every day, in different shots around your, I won't name the items they wanted me to photo around that I own.
Yeah.
As that, that can't be what is called social media strategy these days.
No, no. I won't do it either. I just say no a lot. And sometimes the marketing team will say, oh, don't have any like much better rags to riches story. You never like a crack meth addict. You don't have your children repossessed. They sort of joking, but like, you know, your life's just so wholesome and nice, and you have this nice education and nice upbringing, good parenting, and like, you know, the story for, you know, the background is just so straightforward. It's like I was hardworking, did well at school, wanted to do well in business, research good business models, did well at it.
We seem to be caught up in clickbait territory, unfortunately. Whilst Amazon has grown, online sales are growing, which is great. The price we paid is clickbait now, seems to be.
Shock factor.
And with clickbait comes, you need the rag. That apparently people need the big hit, the adrenaline hit, the dopamine hit of this can work, rather than the slow and steady, which I think you and I have done, which is, it's not the sexiest stories, but we just keep showing up and showing up and learning and progressing. And that's worked.
Yeah. I think the love of learning just goes such a long way in business, because if you see every change as like, oh, this is interesting. Like today in New Zealand, there was an announcement that interest on investment properties is no longer tax deductible. But I've been sitting there looking to buy investment properties for the last year, and everything's, you know, 20 or 50% overpriced. So, you know, all these things sort of move around and you pick your timing, and it's, that one might have got some investment properties, but like that one actually might be good for me in the short term because the housing market's been so hot. But, you know, it's just really interesting watching what sells, what catches people's attention. You know, everybody's,
and why it catches their attention.
Yeah
so I can't invest in the stock market because I've got no idea why it's so hot.
No
I can't invest in it because I don't understand. I can't trust my instincts because right now everything's telling me don't be in the market because it just seems to be hot for, based on no metrics I understand.
Lots of new retail investors through Robinhoods and all these new platforms that popped up.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of uneducated money cranking in there because they can't buy houses at the moment.
Yes.
And they've got stimulus checks in the States and, you know, furlough income and all sorts. So I find the whole marketing industry fascinating. I mean, I'd like to watch it as an outsider rather than having to produce videos as much as we do. But
yes.
You know, I do keep my life very private. I don't sort of, I live in an old 70s holiday home in Wanaka. I mean, it's the most beautiful town. There's no jobs here. It's like, don't know what the average house price is in the millions, but, you know, I live in a really modest house, don't have a flashy life, you know, just have a really, really comfortable life, really well-designed, really good quality, time with children, horse, you know, like that's how my life is, you know, it's really cool. And I don't fear losing anything. If I want to go and travel the world, I can just hop on a plane and go, and there's no COVID. But, you know, I've got lots of freedom and not lots of material stuff, and that really suits me, just keeping it really low key. None of the school mums on the school run have a clue what I do. I mean, some of them sometimes see a Facebook ad, but they all think I've just got some horses or something.
Really?
Yeah, I don't really tell anyone what I do.
Interesting.
If they ask, I'll tell them, but, you know, people haven't got a clue. It's very nice to be under the radar and just quietly having a very healthy source of income, great lifestyle, get to go running and horsing and family time, and that's more important than just
I think it depends on why people go into business. The thing I say to my clients is business should be your most boring source of, like, it should be a boring source of income. It should be predictable. You need to know where next year is coming from. The more boring and predictable you can make it, the better you're doing. The moment you think you need to get your significance from it or your highs from it or it needs to feed whatever it is within you. If you feel a yearning to something has to happen in business for you to feel good about you, that's not a good reason to be in business. Be in business because it's helping you craft the lifestyle you want, not because it's going to somehow fulfill you.
Yeah.
Feel fulfilled and bring that to business. Don't think something outside of you can fulfill you. It can't be that way around. Yeah. I'm quoting a little bit of Buddhism here, but I really am. I think it's true that if we bring to business the need for it to fulfill us and to be everything to us and somehow make us complete, along with anything else we try materially gain, we're not going to bring the right energy and make the right choices. Whereas what you've done is made an approach to business, it's going to fulfill, it's going to solve this problem for me. Mm-hmm. And it's going to give me the freedom to then be me.
Yeah.
Whereas other people, they look at business as how I am me.
Yeah.
Do you get the difference? Like, and then that's really hard place to be, that I identify as the business. I am the business. It needs to do this for me. It's too much.
It's probably not a very good business, even if it gives you that satisfaction feeling or the chance to be the star. If the business can only be working and earning while you're the star of it, you can't really stop. You can't have a day off. You can't retire. It is you. Yes. And then it's a job, not a business.
So Michael Gerber, the way I know him, years ago when I started out, we were doing very, very well in the beginning. It took off so fast, but I was everything. I was the star. And he said to me, and I'm going to try and quote him inaccurately, but something like, get over the narcissistic need to be to sell anything that requires you. Mm-hmm. I'd known him for like a minute and he handed that out. It's priceless.
Yeah.
Great crisis. System. So I then went about making decisions in my business for the next 15 years that was not about any narcissistic obsession to have me as the star or required to be in the room.
Yeah.
And that's how I built the business, just on that one piece of advice. I loved it. It was fantastic.
Yeah. Brilliant. Oh, that's a great one.
Yeah, it is. Now, where could people find out more about you, Sophie, and connect and maybe find out about how they can go onto Amazon?
The link to go to is blueskyamazon.com. And from there, you'll be able to watch some intro videos and then work your way through to signing up to the whole program if you're ready to do that. So that will get you on the right tracks. If you're ready to do it, we're here to help and love helping people do Amazon the right way.
Yeah. I like your approach to it. It's really thoughtful and it's very appealing to me that it's not just find the latest bandwagon and just copy what's being done. I like the uniqueness that you bring to it. It's very, very appealing to me. I like that.
Brilliant. I think the kind of products I would sell are the kind I would buy myself.
Yeah.
And the program I've designed is the one that I would want someone to teach me if I was learning. So quite good if you do things as if they were for yourself, because then you know what people want.
Yeah,
so only appeals to like-minded people, but you know, if that's the right fit for you, then feel really happy that this program is going to teach you everything you need to know.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Sophie. Really appreciate you.
Thank you, Sharon.